I'll start us off in prayer, and then we'll get started. Father in heaven, we are thankful for a beautiful day today after the cold weather we've had and the snow and the dreariness. We're thankful for the sunshine. We're thankful for another day where we can come and learn more about you and about your world and your history. And I just pray that you would open our eyes and ears to new things and help us to consider and think about our history and just give us wisdom as we think about how to move forward as Christians in this community. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. So, we're continuing our study in a theological interpretation of American history. And let's see, we have done Puritanism, then we went from Puritanism to deism, Unitarianism, Transcendentalism, and that brings us up to around the Civil War era, and we're going to talk about social Darwinism today. Not just Darwinism, which could be its whole topic in and of itself, but we're going to talk about more about the effects of Darwinism on the culture and politics. And it actually is two different things. I mean, even with all the negatives of Charles Darwin, he was not a fan of social Darwinism. He didn't like where the country was headed, applying his theories to politics and sociology. But Charles Darwin, we do have to begin there. Because it's his book, Origin of the Species, 1859, right before the Civil War. The book comes out and is a massive influence. Of course, Charles Darwin is not the first person to come up with these theories. Charles Darwin was, his grandfather, Erasmus, had done a lot of research and study in the areas of evolution, all the aspects of it. There was Lamarck, who was a scientist that was researching that, organs are developed or diminished by use or disuse, and that the resulting changes may be transmitted to future generations. So the idea of, you know, this natural selection, you know, that you will change over time according to your surroundings. Charles Lyell. Some of these scientists were already developing some of these theories. So Charles Darwin's the one that sort of put it in a book and had the biggest influence. That's Darwinism. Social Darwinism, though, is the application of these evolutionary concepts, and it's applied to really every avenue of life. This is how massive this theory was during this time. Where, remember I said Transcendentalism was sort of this small, it had a massive influence because of these men and women were writers, and they were in the academic realm, and so they had a big influence on people that were going to college and sort of the high upper class. Darwinism affected, sort of just went into everywhere. Even the South, which had basically been able to hold off a lot of these things like deism and Transcendentalism, the South was greatly affected by Darwinism as well. So social Darwinism is evolution applied to economics, politics, sociology, the arts, philosophy, psychology, and theology. Now, there's a lot that we could talk about in terms of evolution. The two big concepts are natural selection, again, which is the idea that there's heritable traits that are characteristic of a population. They can change over generations. And then there's the survival of the fittest. Herbert Spencer and William Graham Sumner are sort of the two big names associated with social Darwinism. Herbert Spencer was in England. Sumner was in America. He deals mostly with Sumner just because he's the American personality. But Herbert Spencer, you can't really talk about social Darwinism and not mention him. His book came out in 1962 called First Principles of a New System of Philosophy. he had read Charles Darwin. So Spencer had become started coming up with a lot of these ideas as a philosopher. He read Darwin, and that was sort of the final piece of the puzzle for him. And he was, oh yes, this light came on. He started writing about this idea of how to apply, how does a world, a culture, like how can we make sense of the way things are supposed to be? Oh, evolution, okay. And then he fit that in. And basically his idea is that the end point of the evolutionary process would be the creation of the perfect man in the perfect society, with human beings becoming completely adapted to social life. He actually is the guy that coined the phrase survival of the fittest. That's not Darwin. This is Spencer said that. And he actually applied it in terms of economic competition. So it's sort of been put back into evolution when we talk about animals and you talk about the moth or, you know, whatever it may be, these animals in evolutionary philosophy, you know, when they're talking about survival of the fittest, it actually was first applied to economics. And Spencer had a massive influence, and Sumner had a massive influence on men like Rockefeller, Carnegie, Vanderbilt, a lot of these, you know, this is the era of the big, you know, the powerful, the rich, they're coming into power, especially in America. William Sumner was actually an Episcopalian priest who became convinced of Darwinism when he was in school and then applied these concepts to social thought. So you have Spencer sort of making an impact in economics. And it's interesting because Spencer was greatly influenced by the Austrian economics. You know, Ayn Rand is a big follower of his. And what it is sort of this libertarianism taken to this idea of survival of the fittest. And so it really doesn't matter what's best for society, it's what is actual for society. And so the strongest will survive, and that's the way it goes. And if you just aren't strong enough, you're going to get cut off and thrown to the wolves. William Sumner applied this to social thought. He says, if we do not like the survival of the fittest, we have only one possible alternative, and that is the survival of the unfittest. The former is the law of civilization. The latter is the law of anti-civilization. Remember, this was a former priest in the Episcopal Church. We have our choice between the two, or we can go on, as in the past, facilitating between the two. But a third plan is a plan for nourishing the unfittest and yet advancing civilization no man will ever find. So he's basically saying, let's stop wasting our time on these weak, poor people. You know, it's sort of pointless. We need to leave them in the dust and move forward as a society. That's what survival of the fittest is. He goes on to say that society's laws are as fixed as natural laws. So in the same way that Darwin was saying that, you know, these evolutionary laws, you know, that's the way they're, you know, that's the way life happens. Sumner is saying this is the way society happens. You can't stop it. This is the way it goes. If you try to stop it, you're just putting off the inevitable. He said nothing but might has ever made right. And if we include in might, as we ought, elections and the doctrines of the courts, nothing but might makes right now. If a thing has been done and is established by force, that is, that no force can reverse it, it is right in the only sense we can know. So, this is might makes right, and it's the only right that we can actually know. And rights will follow from it, which are not vitiated at all by the forces in it. There would be no security at all for rights if this were not so. So the only way to secure your rights is to take them by force, is to enforce these rights. So might makes right, and that's the only way to guarantee rights is through might. Rights can never be natural or God-given or absolute in any sense. Survival of the fittest economics, this style of economics, was built upon, is sort of built upon that laissez-faire doctrine of Adam Smith. But there was one major difference. Smith and the Enlightenment guys that we had talked about, they had an understanding of natural law in the social contract. Remember, we talked about that in Locke and the social contract and this contract we enter in as a society when we elect representatives. They at least, even though we can go back and see that there was damage done, they at least understood that there was an existence of a common good, and that this common good was objective, and it was moral in content. We're past that now. That the foundation they laid, the obvious, we look at it, the obvious consequences of it is now evolution, social Darwinism. Social Darwinism, as conceived by Spencer and Sumner, was contrary to all previous American constitutional philosophy and political practice, which is exactly what evolution is. It makes sense. They can justify the direction they're going because that makes sense in evolutionary theory. So they had their basis formed in their philosophy. So they can do what they want because that is what evolution actually is. Might makes right. Now, I'm going to take a little side trip here because in some other reading I was doing, so the sort of the concept of this book is, how did the theology affect the politics? But I think there's also a way that you can look back and see that how did the politics affect the theology in a sense. I was reading about the debate of, in 1930, the Daniel Webster versus Hayne. I don't know if any of you have read it. It used to be, I don't know if it's even in the teaching in the public schools, but it's a major debate in the history of America. 1930, you're post-Revolutionary War. You're post the War of 1812. There's this era called the Era of Good Feelings. You know, we've kind of... What did I say? Did I say? Okay, 1830. So we're post-Revolutionary War. We're in this era of good feeling. We haven't quite come to the Civil War yet. And so there's this sort of air of accomplishment. You know, we're working together. Even though there's definitely some problems that are bubbling to the surface, this debate is sort of, many people consider the first time that secession was really considered. And really the debate was simply just over what to do with these western lands west of the Mississippi. What do we do with them? We got all this land over here. Daniel Webster from Massachusetts wants the land for the government to continue revenue. It's a revenue source. It should be the possession of the government. Hayne from South Carolina saying no. No, that's not what we need to be doing. It needs to be the possession of the states themselves. That quickly turned into a debate of federal government versus states' rights. But the thing that's interesting in that debate, and there's a lot we could talk about, but the thing that's really interesting is this debate sort of, you know, continued. I think that it went back and forth 3 or 4 times between the two of them. What you get is Hayne, who is referring back to the Constitution as a historical document that was set in a specific period of time. This is how you understand what the Constitution means. Daniel Webster is over here saying, no, the Constitution is this thing that evolves over time. And this is where I sort of get this idea, you know, because Daniel Webster is actually arguing, he doesn't really use the word evolve, he uses the word notion. This word notion pops up over and over. The notion of this document, the notion of these people, basically the idea is, I know the Constitution doesn't really talk about the people as this, you know, a nation, but that's what it needs to mean now. And so we need to, you know, we need to evolve what we, you know, as a nation. And Hayne is sitting here going, no, it's a union. The whole point of the Constitution was to make states stronger. Daniel Webster saying, yeah, well, maybe it did mean that, but now it needs to mean this thing over here. It needs to evolve. And so without actually using the word revolution, Daniel Webster is making a case that as a society, we need to evolve into something else. That sort of is what got my wheels turning, because I'm thinking, you know, evolution, the theory of evolution starts popping up right after that in England. But then, of course, like I said, I mean, 1959, Darwin. So we're talking 20 years after this, you have a theory of evolution that is quickly applied to politics that now makes sense of what, you know, like this is Webster's view coming into fulfillment. You know, Haynes' view is going by the wayside. And, of course, that's what the Civil War, the main thrust of it was this disagreement between how do we view the federal government? What is their role? States' rights versus, you know, a stronger consolidation of government power. But I don't know that that could have not happened unless you have a theory that helps you understand, helps the people to, oh, yeah, so evolution apply. Yes, we need to adapt. We need to grow. We need to evolve, you know. We have notions. We need to give words and meaning to our notions. Daniel Webster was a great orator, I mean, of course, and he's famous for that. But it is interesting that sometimes our political heroes, we look back and think, oh, man, these guys, some of the things they were fighting for has brought us to the troubles that we have now. But one of the things I think is interesting is the Constitution uses the word the people, the phrase the people once, and it's not even used in terms of what Webster was wanting it to mean, like this notion of the people as this whole society, the nation. And Hayne actually addresses that. He's like, that's not what the Constitution means. Like, you're changing the definition. And Webster's like, well, you know, I'm changing it because we need to change it. And if you think about it, I wanted to point out that's the influence of the French Revolution. The French Revolution is about 30 years before this. So in America, it takes a little bit of time for these ideas to travel, but this is simply just what the French Revolution was about too. This idea of the people, you know, sort of rising up and getting what they want over, you know, it's like this democratic view. But there's also, like, think about the Gettysburg Address. You know, 30 years later, we the people, we the people, we the people, we the people. You know, that it became ingrained into our thought, where the Constitution doesn't say that. That's not what the Constitution is arguing. And that's what Haynes' point was. So anyways, already we need, in a sense, we need a theory to support where the country is going, and that's where evolution comes in, and that's where social Darwinism comes in. Social Darwinism was the greatest single, so this is, I'm quoting Singer here, he says, social Darwinism was the greatest single theological and philosophical movement in the second half of the 19th century. And he gives three reasons for this. He says, first of all, social Darwinism was much more in harmony with the post-Revolutionary War spirit the post-Civil War spirit than Transcendentalism, which was, so Transcendentalism, remember, was idealistic. It's this idea that we can attain this perfection, you know, the perfect men, you know, living in the perfect world. And then you go through a bloody civil war and you realize, yeah, that's not quite that easy, is it? And so it didn't really match up with what was going on at the time. Meanwhile, you have the era, like I said, of the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers, Carnegie, Standard Oil Company, Union Pacific, the expansion of America. Transcendentalism doesn't really fit with that either, but social Darwinism does. And again, like I said, these guys were massive. You read quotes by Carnegie and Rockefeller. These guys were, I mean, they picked up on that. I mean, that was the fuel they needed for what they were doing as they were, you know, establishing their power in America. Might makes right. The second thing that Singer says is that social Darwinism fit nicely with the scientific temper of the times. So at this time, science and the scientific method was revered. Now, it was very, we talked about how greatly it was respected and how influential it was when you have men like Isaac Newton, you know, and how he influenced Locke. Well, now science, Singer even uses the word, if it was revered, if not worshipped in some areas. And he says this, he says, the average American of the 1870s was far more prone to give heed to what a scientist would say, not only in regard to his own chosen field, but on politics, social issues, and even theology itself. So we see that nowadays, you know, experts, you know, that's just commonplace. I remember listening to a interview with, this is off the cuff, so hopefully I can remember all the details, but now my mind just went blank, what's the famous physicist that's in the wheelchair and doesn't, Stephen Hawking. I remember hearing an interview with his biographer, and it was on NPR, I think, and so the biographer was actually a Christian, but she was very close to Stephen Hawking, and so she's talking about their relationship, and the NPR interviewer, they get into the subject of theology, and Stephen Hawking said this about God, and the biographer goes, yeah, I know, he said that. And she goes, how can you just dismiss him like that? It's like, because he's not a theologian. Like, that's out of his realm. Like, I don't listen to what Stephen Hawking has to say about the Bible or God. And that NPR interviewer was just beside herself. She could not understand why you would not listen to Stephen Hawking on theology. Well, because he's ignorant when it comes to theology. But anyways, this is where the time we're in is the scientists are the smartest people and, you know, around. We listen to them on everything. It doesn't matter beyond science. They know everything. The third thing that Singer says is the triumph of abolitionism vindicated radicalism. So the North won. You know, the radicals won. So everything that happens after the Civil War, right or wrong, indifferent, whatever, it's right because that's what the history says. That's, you know, the spoils go to the victors. The South did not just lose the battle over states' rights. The loss of the South saw a rapid decline of theological, economic, and social conservatism. So so social Darwinism is ripe for that. You know, the South has a thumb on them, and they are not able to combat what is coming down the pike with social Darwinism. They're just trying to figure out how to rebuild their homes, you know, and how to rebuild society. And so there was a big gap there, about a 30, 40-year gap there where the South just couldn't compete. And so, like I said, Darwinism also had a major influence in the South. And I didn't write anything or, you know, I didn't plan to get into it, but you can even, you know, the Scopes trial and that kind of, you know, you can point back to those moments. Now, to be fair, too, there were people that were advocates of social Darwinism that saw what was happening, that saw the implications of what Sumner was promoting in America and thought, that's not right. But I don't have an answer for it. You know, I've long discarded the Bible, so I have no foundation of morality. But what they're doing in this might makes right doesn't seem right. So how can we combat that? Well, the biggest name that sort of, you know, took the lead there is Lester Frank Ward. And he is associated with the welfare state, beginning the welfare state. What he did, well, so he was repulsed by the lack of ethics in the survival of the fittest, you know, sociology and economics. So what he said was, he was taking evolution, and he said the mind of man should exercise a determining influence on his environment. So not simply that we are created, or not created, but we are evolved in this way, and so the survival of the fittest is whoever's the strongest will continue on. He says, well, no, because, yes, that applies to all the animals, but men, who really are just the smartest animals in this theory, But man has a mind, and so what you have to do is you have to apply your mind to these situations. And so we're smart enough to know that this is not ethical, so we have to figure out a way to care for the other people. Of course, remember, Sumner said, that's pointless. You know, why would we do that? Like, these people need to, you know, be off to the, you know, let them flail. So Lester Frank Ward came up with his, so he wrote a book called Dynamic Sociology. And in this book, he among many things, he's arguing that man was able to control the process of evolution toward goals which he would choose, for the realization of which he would plan a social program. So you can see the influence today. You know, it's this denial of God in all things, but how can we form it to do what we want? Because in reality, men like Sumner and Spencer are honest about their evolution. You know, that's truly what evolution leads to, is might makes right. But you can't, you know, like the government needs to be able, or the state, or whoever is in control needs to be able to shape that to fit their purposes. So you have dynamic sociology. So contrary to Sumner, Ward says that, you know, Sumner again said social planning was foolish and pointless. Lester Frank Ward believes that because we have smart brains, we should be shaping, you know, society to fit our needs. So controlled natural selection. The characteristics that one generation consciously acquired for its own betterment would be transmitted to those which should follow. So the idea of natural selection was that depending on your environment, you know, certain genes would recede, certain genes would come forward, you'd pass it on. And so it's just like, you know, those certain animals that, you know, if they're a rabbit and then they live in these cold weather environments and the snow, they're, you know, over time they become white rabbits because the, you know, evolution, they've evolved and now they can protect themselves and camouflage themselves. Well, he's applying that to people, but what he's saying is if we are very specific about these genes that we pass on, if we are selective about our natural selection, we can control the direction that our environment is going to go. Singer says this. He says, it was a program of the scientific betterment of the human situation. For Ward insisted that science was the only means by which mankind ever has been or ever can be improved, for science utilizes the materials furnished by nature for this purpose. Now, Ward was an avowed atheist. A lot of these guys, they would say maybe they were Christian. Like Darwin, up until the final days, I think near the end of his life, he did say he was agnostic, but would not say he was atheistic. Like I said, I mean, even men like Sumner, who were former Episcopalian preachers, I don't think he ever denied that there was a God, but it just, he had no business in science. Lester Frank Ward, the father of the welfare state, was adamant there is no God. And so he says that we can't rely. There is no God. It's only science. And if we're going to make this world a better place, it will only be through science. It was a process by which the forces of evolution would be guided towards the realization of human happiness, which, and this is the words he used, you know, he's taken from the, going back to the Puritans here, which was man's chief end in life. So, the purpose of education was to enable man to achieve the conquest of nature, which would lead to that happiness that we desired and needed. So we talked about this a little bit last week with the transcendentalists. Now we're going to really get into it this week. Is education became the most vital aspect of creating this new society. Ward, so I mentioned how Spencer was sort of he was a capitalist, and he applied his views into a capital. He was very much against Marx. He was very much against the socialists. Now you have, in America, though, the biggest influence is Lester Frank Ward, who is a socialist, very much influenced by socialism and collectivism, I guess, would what it would have been better known as back then. But so war promoted collective achievement, the realization of human happiness for human beings who could not realize it by their own individual actions. This is where you start to get, he doesn't get into it this much, but this is doing a little research. This is about the same time you also start getting into eugenics, the problems of eugenics, the problems of genocide, and sort of this, you know, it traces itself, again, because people, despite their wickedness, they many times are honest about these things, you know, and you have people in history like Margaret Sanger you can look at and say they're honest about their beliefs. So here you have people that recognize that there's something wrong with this way of thinking, but they refuse to submit to God. And so they're manipulating their views to reach their desired goals. So there's a realization here that there are weak people, there are dumb people, there are people that don't deserve life, but these people are saying, yes, but we need to care for them. So they recognize that we need to care, you know, but they're still saying that, oh, well, there's these lesser people in society. There's the strong, and then there's the weak. Some people say, you know what, we need to just get rid of the weak. But the beginning of the welfare state is simply we need to take care of them because they can't take care of themselves. Does that make sense? I hope I'm not generalizing too much. But yeah, I mean, but that's what's going on here. There's a recognition that there are lesser people, but we do need to somehow bring them up and bring them along and take care of them. And of course, in my point, what I would, you know, I think we all agree. I mean, these are not lesser people. You know, so that's the point there is simply that evolution, regardless of how you tweak it to fit your needs, I mean, there's still the view there that there are weak, there are strong, and they can't do things for themselves. So he openly advocated for social achievement through the government, which set the stage for the welfare state. Not long after this, you have the New Deal and the onslaught of governmental programs that followed, and that'll probably be what we talk about next week. I'll probably combine. So the next thing in the next chapter is the social gospel. I'll probably combine social gospel and the New Deal together. It's sort of the same time period. He makes it two different chapters, but I think we can combine those two things together. But that's what's down the pike is the New Deal, all these social, you know, these governmental programs. Of course, you have the Depression, which preceded that. And of course, the Depression follows what's happening in America right now under this, you know, this just onslaught of competition, of survival of the fittest that's happening where there's this massive economic growth happening in America right now, and the bottom is about to fall out. So, and then you see the consequences of that. Of course, social evolution, social Darwinism didn't fall away after that. It has such a stronghold at this point that it never, I mean, we still have it in our, even people that, you know, again, I don't want to get into this. It blows my mind because people buy into it so hard, and there's literally no proof at all. It's just a theory. It's a theory of biology. It's a theory of economics. It's a theory of sociology. But it's given now. It's a given view. But anyways, let me get back to what I was talking about. What was I saying? I'm still talking about Lester Frank Ward. So here's the final thing about Lester Frank Ward. He said this. Again, this is the guy that wants, through education, to make a difference in changing society. He says this. He declared that the family, in its origin, was simply an institution for the more complete subjugation and enslavement of women and children. The primitive family was an unnatural, and here's big autocratic excretions upon society. Basically, it's a growth. It's an unwanted, it's like a cancer. We need to get rid of it. We need to cut it out. So while Spencer and Sumner had this tremendous impact and influence on the political and business development in the country, Ward had the greater influence upon American constitutional development. Right after Ward, in 1902, Oliver Wendell Holmes is appointed to Supreme Court by Theodore Roosevelt. Oliver Wendell Holmes insisted that the law must adapt itself to a changing social environment. Right after this, you have the influence in criminology. Criminals should be dealt with in terms of the causes of their actions rather than in terms of the crime itself. Rehabilitation toward forsaking antisocial behavior. That's, you know, now we're treating criminals as, you know, they just have antisocial behaviors and they need to just be, you know, educated properly. But I do want to get into the education aspect here. And the word that fits this is pragmatism. And John Dewey, Ward initially said this, John Dewey took it to its next step, and the idea is, so John Dewey says that he takes empiricism. Remember, empiricism is how you know something, and the empiricists were simply, you know something because you can actually touch it, you can test it, you can see it for yourself. John Dewey took it the next step and says, it's not just that. Mere experience does not constitute knowledge, but the use which the individual makes of this knowledge gained through experience. The only knowledge is the useful knowledge that can help a society. So right there, education changes because no longer do we study history or English literature or math for the sake of knowing something. Now we study for the sake of fitting into the big machine. How can you serve? How can you be a good citizen? That's what education is now turning into. Singer says this about Dewey. He says, for Dewey, there was no such thing as objective absolute truth, but only warranted assertability, by which he meant something that could be taken to be true because it had worked in human experience and therefore had an instrumental worth or value. Are you good for society? That's what's true. If you're not good for society, then that's false. So in order to be good for society, we need to figure out how to make you fit in, you know, your role in society. Dewey rewrote American educational practice in light of his evolutionary philosophy. By 1895, Dewey was putting his theories to test in his famous experimental school at the University of Chicago. And by 1920, the public schools were flooded with his disciples. Child-centered curriculum replaced the traditional subjects which dealt with objective truth and factual data in the sciences and math and history and language. The new curriculum was designed for the training of better citizens, grounded in the belief that man was the most intelligent of animals, but an animal nonetheless. Singer says this. He says, their philosophy denied that children were personalities and were therefore worthy of being taught. Dewey not only had no truth to teach, but no one to teach it to except animals of a fairly high intelligence, who were then to be taught by other animals of the same general level of intellectual ability. In light of these facts, it is no wonder that progressive education made a mockery of the very practice of teaching. History, for instance, was only useful if it contributed to the furthering of the present democratic society. Singer notes that this had disastrous consequences upon the students. They lost almost all contact with the history of the nation, except as certain selected events and moments and movements were used to illustrate contemporary issues and events. They actually knew so little about their national past that the present lost most of its meaning for them. There was in Dewey's philosophy of education a devouring anti-intellectualism, this is Singer saying this. Remember, Singer wrote in the 80s. So the next two things I'm going to say, it's prefaced with, if you only knew, if you saw what was happening today. So he said, he's sort of prophesying. He's saying, and again, it makes sense, right? You know, anti-intellectualism in this new education. And you think about even the cliches, if you think about like 80s movies and culture of how anti-intellectual school is, you know, and just the cliches of sort of like the nerd, you know, the person that's learning is the nerd, you know, and the cool people are the people that are kind of sit off to the side and smoking the boys. You know, it's a complete reshaping of what education was. So Singer says this. He says, there was in Dewey's philosophy of education a devouring anti-intellectualism, which, if not checked, would ultimately destroy the entire system. He says the changes which have taken place in education are not merely a subtraction of a former definitely Christian philosophy. So the idea is not simply that they removed prayer from schools, they removed the Ten Commandments. It's not just that they subtracted these things. They are an addition of elements which can only bring about the destruction, not just of education, but of the American system of government. And that's where I'll wrap this up. But think about that. Like, even Singer is recognizing the fact that because the education system was destroyed, the impact is on our political system. These are the people educated this way that are now taking leadership roles in our society. And so we're here now dealing with the things that we're dealing with because of what happened in the, you know, previous generations in the education movement. So that's Singer's prophecy, but we're seeing the end of it now. But any questions? I think we're at our time. We can get snacks or whatever, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. It was a lot. This was a big chapter, and there was a lot I left out, but if I'd just started at 9:45, I could have. All right, go get donuts.